If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue.
Thanks for tuning in,
and welcome to the May 18th, 2020 Shelter in Place edition of IMRU Radio Magazine. Hello, I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Chris Ann Eastwood.
As we said last week, like most of America, we're obsessed with Ryan Murphy's Hollywood on Netflix.
Murphy's fantasy depiction of Tinseltown's golden age reimagined as diverse, inclusive, and unabashedly queer.
So for a second week, we're dipping into the IMRU archives for glances at LGBTQ Tinseltown.
We chat with director Bill Condon about Frankenstein director James Whale and the film Gods and Monsters.
Pride on Screen gives a recap of talkies to Technicolor.
And finally, a visit with Tab Hunter in his Santa Barbara home to talk about the book and the documentary Tab Hunter, Confidential.
We're starting with David Ehrenstein's book, Open Secret, Gay Hollywood, 1928 to 1998.
Once I had a secret love that lived within the heart of me.
For decades, talking about who's gay in Hollywood has been a favorite pastime in both the gay and mainstream communities. It happens around water coolers, at cocktail parties, on the internet, and is the bread and butter of supermarket tabloids. David Ehrenstein has been writing about gays in Hollywood for over 30 years. His book from William Morrow & Company is called Open Secret, Gay Hollywood, 1928 through 98. Its publication was eagerly awaited by gay film buffs and watched carefully by star attorneys and publicists.
And why I'm so in love with you.
A lot of what goes on in the writing of this book is explaining the differences in time periods, in places, in people. There is not simply this given gay, lesbian group of people living in hostile circumstances, and now things are getting better or something, or we're talking about it more or something like that. That's not really the way it works. The whole idea of a gay lesbian community is something that has developed over time and changed a lot over time.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of Hollywood. Yeah, the chapter in your book I'm talking about is Invisible City.
Right, yeah. Well, that has to do with the way that the curious kind of city that Los Angeles is and how it was laid out. I mean, right now we're living in 24-hour gridlock. Cannot get across this town. I came out here from New York. I moved out here in the mid-70s, and you could have bowling parties in the middle of La Brea Boulevard. It was empty. Then all of a sudden, kaboom, and it's all, you know, crowded in. But in the old days, in studio days, you know, there were these orange groves and farms in all this area, and little enclaves where people would live. So people could have really, really private lives. Far more private than in a city like New York and Chicago, where there is a social world that is sort of set, and you run into the same people all the time. You had to watch over your shoulder who was looking at you. Out here is quite different, because if you were gay in Hollywood and you had some sort of success, you could buy a house and you could buy a pool and you could fight over a lot of cute boys and have a wonderful time. But and it isn't a question of people looking the other way. They weren't even looking in your direction. because the whole notion of dealing with gays and lesbians in any, or matters gay and lesbian in any frank and honest way is a very recent development. In the studio era, this was all very much remote hipster conversation about such things.
We've all seen the movie L.A. Confidential. Did Confidential magazine have a large impact?
Confidential violated the rules that existed up to now, in which the legitimate press, so-called, the mainstream media, so-called, would never cover such things, would never really get into various affairs. You know, I mean, MGM had an abortionist on staff. And that was all not discussed.
But they discussed it. They outed Tab Hunter.
The outing of Tab Hunter is like the biggest thing that happened. Tab Hunter was, in 1951, was arrested at a party in Walnut Park. He was arrested for disorderly conduct. And the charges, there was knocked down. He paid, you know, $50 fine, suspended sentence. It was nothing. But it was there. The record of it was there. So Confidential magazine published the story about it in 1955. And in 1955, Battle Cry was coming out, which was this gigantic Warner Brothers movie. And there was this huge launch for Tab Hunter related to that. And here was Confidential. And in the magazine, they reprinted the actual rap sheet with his name, Arthur Andrew Gallen, and all of the information, plus their own little smarmy take on the party, which they would have you believe was an orgy. Well, it wasn't. And one of the things in putting this book together is discovering exactly what happened. You could get arrested in a private home for same-sex dancing or fraternizing. They could just come in there and bust you. So he had this little mark on his record, and there was Confidential blaring it for the world to see. Well, what does this mean? Is this the end of Tab Hunter? Is Warner Brothers going to throw him to the cold? No, it's not what happened. Warner Brothers did nothing. Nothing happened to Tab Hunter. He had his career and was, you know, the best Tab Hunter he could be. And that was that. So the myth of, oh, if they find out you, it's so horrible and they'll throw you out in the cold, doesn't happen. Does not happen.
Speaking of Tab Hunter, I was surprised by some of the matches or couples you listed in your book, Tab Hunter.
You're awfully wonderful. And I wish I was two people, but I'm only one.
And Anthony Perkins.
Oh, that must be my mother. She's an invalid. It's practically like living alone.
Montgomery Clift.
But what's it going to be like next week? All summer long. I'll still be just as much in love with you.
Then Jack Larson, Jimmy Olsen from the Superman series.
Cute? Can't you think of some other word to call it, Miss Lane?
Yeah, that was a very interesting sidelight to this book. I wanted to talk to Jack Larson. I talked to Jack. A lot of the times I would pre-interview people to explain to them exactly what I was doing, what the book was about, and simply say to them, whatever contribution you would like to make, that's all that I'm interested in. I'm not out after wild, scandalous gossip of any kind. So I talked to him, and he finally turned me down. He wasn't ready for it. Well, then, just a month before the book went to press, suddenly he gives an interview with the New York Times, and, you know, yes, and, you know, and I had an affair with Montgomery Clift. Well, you know, if I'd had an affair with Montgomery Clift, I would have hired a skywriter, and it would have been all over Los Angeles and every major city in the country, because we were talking about the Montgomery Clift of the heiress, the Montgomery Clift of a place in the sun, one of the most beautiful creatures ever set on this earth. But it's difficult for some people, and certainly for a man of his generation. And he's quite a brilliant man. And then of course, he was with writer-director James Bridges for, I think it was 38 years, I think. Thank you.
Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, director James Whale, was expertly captured in Bill Condon's 1998 film, Gods and Monsters.
Steve Pride spoke with Condon about the openly gay Whale and the making of the award-winning film.
We are friends, you and
You're
I.
Hurt my boyfriend.
Isn't the monster dead yet?
No.
Perfect night, mystery and horror.
Friend. Good.
Friend. Friend.
The air itself is filled with monsters.
In 1957, following a stroke that left him in a state of constant mental deterioration, director James Whale, a man notoriously afraid of water, took his own life by drowning himself in the shallow end of his swimming pool. His death at age 67 merited only a couple of paragraphs in Variety, and his funeral took place in a small West Side chapel. Things had been different in the 1930s when he directed a trio of horror pictures that would influence generations of filmmakers and shape popular culture to this day: Frankenstein, The Invisible Man, and Bride of Frankenstein. Long after his death, movie historians would afford Whale his place in history as the man who perfected the horror genre by humanizing the monster and using humor. This year, Whale's Frankenstein made the American Film Institute's list of greats at number 87. A biography was released, and now Gods and Monsters offers us a fictional account of his tragic final days. It stars Ian McKellen as Whale in an Academy Award-caliber performance. In this scene, Ian McKellen's James Whale meets his new gardener, Clayton Boone, played by Brendan Fraser. McKellen portrays James Whale as elegant, complex, and extremely seductive.
You must excuse my staring, but you have the most marvelous head.
To an artistic eye. Have you ever modeled?
What, you mean like posed for pictures?
Sat for an artist. Been sketched.
What's the sketch?
You have the most architectural skull. And your nose, it's very expressive.
Broke is more like it.
Sorry to go on like this. It's just the Sunday painter in me. I quite understand your refusal. It's a great deal to ask of anyone.
You mean you really want to draw me?
I would pay for the privilege of drawing that head.
And it's just my head that you want to draw? I mean, nothing else?
Now, what are you suggesting? That you'll charge extra if I include a hand or a bit of shoulder?
No, I mean, you don't want to draw pictures of me on my birthday suit, do you?
I have no interest in your body, Mr. Boone. I can assure you of that.
Not only is Brendan Fraser able to hold his own against McKellen's career-best performance, but Lynn Redgrave as Hannah, James Whale's housekeeper, is astounding.
So, have you ever been married?
Of course, I'm married still.
So what does your husband do?
He's dead now. 20 years.
Well, then you're as single as I am.
No, I have children and grandchildren, too. I visit when I can. Of course, now Mr. Jimmy cannot be left alone for long, so I do not get out much. Poor Mr. Jimmy. There is much good in him, but he will suffer the fires of hell. It's very sad.
You sure of that?
That's what the priests tell me. His sins of the flesh will keep him from heaven.
And hell, everybody's got those.
No, his is the worst. The unspeakable. The deed no man can name without shame. What is the good English? All I know is bugger. He's a bugger. Men who bugger each other.
A homo.
Yes, you know. That is why he must go to hell. I do not think it's fair, but God's laws is not for us to judge.
Recently, I sat down for a talk with the writer-director of Gods and Monsters, Bill Condon. Could you tell me a little bit about James Whale?
Sure. He was born in the north of England, working-class man who became an officer in World War I, was in the trenches for a couple of years, then in a POW camp. When he came out of there, because, of course, that war decimated an entire generation of men, there were suddenly slots open in the world. He could go to London, and he wasn't stuck sort of living in the working class town that he'd been born in. He went there, became a designer, a cartoonist, and eventually a theater director, a stage director. Directed this play called Journey's End, which became the surprise hit. That brought him to New York, and it just happened to be around the time that so many stage directors were being imported to Los Angeles because actors were starting to talk and they needed somebody to help them do that. So he came the same year that Cukor did. The first movie he worked on actually was Hell's Angels. He did the dialogues. He directed the dialogue scenes that Gene Harlow was in for Howard Hughes. Became a quick success, signed a contract at Universal, and made Frankenstein, which was an enormous hit. So suddenly, he was really the apple of Junior Lemley's eye. Junior Lemley ran production there. And for about 5 years, Whale found this niche within a studio system. He was almost an independent filmmaker, truly had nobody looking over his shoulder, so that he made a series of movies, The Old Dark House, The Invisible Man, The Bride of Frankenstein, Showboat, a few others, that really strongly bore his imprint. You know, I think that's what keeps him so fresh today. It's strange. Recently, Sight and Sound did a survey of international film critics, the 360 best films of all time, and Whale had three movies on that list. And that's all different countries, too. The films endure because of that, I think, because they are so truly his. I'm sure a lot of people have seen those. Obviously, what's most notable is this really, really macabre, eccentric wit that he brings to these movies, an amazing sense of style. And throughout, you know, the thing that kind of connects him thematically is this really strong connection emotionally with the outcast in his story, with the outsider, most notably, obviously, Frankenstein.
Do you think that's connected with him being a gay man?
I think it's probably to a large degree that. I also think it's a class thing. I think he always had his nose pressed against the window in England, you know, and then here he was able to recreate himself as a gentleman, you know, and nobody knew the difference. So I think it's probably a combination of his sexuality and his background.
Tell me about his relationship with David Lewis.
Well, he came when Whale came here. He got to know Lewis, who is an associate producer at MGM, worked for Irving Thalberg, worked on Camille, for example, and then became a producer within the studio system. And they lived together for 15 years, very openly gay in Hollywood in the 30s and 40s. That was a different culture. It was a more sophisticated culture than it turned into during the war and afterwards, and during the Cold War, when suddenly men really had to be men and you had to sniff out the ones that weren't. But they were especially comfortable with it, I think, in that society.
What was the genesis of the film Gods and Monsters?
Well, I'd read Chris Bram's novel and talked to him, and with my partner Greg Feinberg, we optioned the book, and I wrote the script over the next 6 months, then sent it to Ian McKellen. Took him a little while to read it, then he did. He met us at Clive Barker's house. Clive had become involved as an executive producer, and after a few meetings, he decided that he was going to do the movie. And from that point on, it probably took about 2 years until we started to shoot, but during that time, we took it to various companies with Ian's attachment. One company, Regent, became interested, and then we got other actors attached. Lynn Redgrave, Brendan Fraser, Lolita Davidovich. I think, in a way, Ian was a magnet for them, as well as I think they were interested in the parts that they were playing. So it was a long process, I think, probably a typical period of time, you know, to get a movie of this scale off the ground.
It sounds like it was a very hard sell.
It was, yes. Ironically, there are some places that are considered gay-friendly, where you would expect that maybe a film about a notable gay figure would be an easier sell. But there are a few people there who said, well, you know, here's this guy who was openly gay in the 1930s and had a wonderful career. Why are we focusing on the bad times, you know, why the end of his life, why the man in decline? Obviously, the answer is it's more interesting. And it just gets to things thematically that are a lot deeper than just seeing somebody, you know, in a typical sort of biopic way creating Frankenstein or something like that, although, of course, we do that in the movie in short flashbacks. So I think that we did face the PC police a little bit in that case, you know. It wasn't sort of one of these sort of upbeat lifestyle movies, you know. Cheerful boosterism movies, and if you know, so yeah, it was hard to get made.
Lynn Redgrave so disappeared into a role. Yeah. I was surprised it was Lynn Redgrave when the credits rolled.
Oh, she loves it when people say that. I think that, yeah, I think that's her favorite thing to do. She's such a great character actress. Yeah, I remember the first time she showed up at rehearsal at the house, and she actually, I think it was oranges or something, fruit that she put into her bra, and she had this big black dress on, and she was already becoming Hannah. It was wonderful to see. I've heard that she has a great ear for accents, which turned out to be true, and she was so meticulous about it, spent time with an Hungarian woman, Ava, and really, really learned it. You know, there's a little speech she does actually on the phone to her daughter in Hungarian. I have no idea what she says. I'm always wondering if she's, you know, get me off this movie, they're paying me no money, or something like that.
Among the flashback scenes, you recreate the Frankenstein set. Was that fun?
Oh, it was so much fun. You know, we couldn't find the original plans, and Richard Sherman, the production designer, and his team just actually took frames from the film and duplicated. We couldn't find the props either, so those were all rebuilt. And then to finally see it up, my God, I think at one point or another, everybody wound up running up those steps the way that they do in that movie over and over again. I think everyone was just so thrilled. We couldn't make it as high as the original was because we were on a smaller stage. We weren't at Universal, but there is some connection to horror history. We were on the stage where Whatever Happened to Baby Jane was shot, so that's another bit of Hollywood camp, I guess.
I think if I had to describe your film to a friend and said, hey, let's go see this, it would not be, this is a film about a gay guy, this is a film about old Hollywood, and it's wonderful.
It's about old Hollywood, it's about, I mean, because Brendan Fraser's character isn't gay, so I mean, it's really half and half. I think it's really about this unlikely relationship between these two and seeing that there's a kind of Pinter-esque power play that happens in the movie between these two characters. Whale and Clay, and at each point one is a god and a monster, you know, but there's no question, I think, that that's the enduring appeal, I think, of Frankenstein and Phantom of the Opera, a number of monsters, that we all really feel like them. We feel misunderstood in that way, and we also feel like, like monsters.
Gods and Monsters is a Lionsgate release. This is Steve Pride.
Gods and Monsters is available to stream free on Amazon Prime and Hulu, or to rent on iTunes, YouTube, or Google Play.
Don't go away. We'll be right back.
John Cage, composer and music theorist, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. One of the most influential and controversial American composers of the 20th century, John Cage is best known for music with an element of chance. Born in 1912 with a creative soul, he was composing by the mid-1930s while developing ideas about sound and noise. Cage married in 1935, but divorce would follow after meeting male dance student Merce Cunningham. The two eventually became lifelong partners and artistic collaborators. Cage's avant-garde compositions weren't entirely structured, employing miscellaneous sound-making devices like electrical buzzers or tin cans, allowing them to sound off randomly. He strove to create a one-of-a-kind piece that ultimately took shape in the listener's imagination. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John Porter.
Hello, I am Dennis Shepard, Matthew Shepard's father, and you're listening to IMRU Radio Magazine.
Well, what kind of bar is this? Why aren't there any women in here? It's a what? It's a gay bar. Well, hell, I've had a little fun with the fellas now and then, but you know, if you're gonna have a bar, you gotta have ladies. Well, of course you can buy me a drink. That was.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Chris Ann Eastwood.
Steve Pride has been covering queer film for over 25 years.
And in a special Pride on Screen, he recaps LGBTQ images on the big screen from 1934 to 1982.
Queer cinema is as old as the motion picture. But the 1930 enactment of the Motion Picture Production Code prohibited any depiction of or inference to sexual perversion. That's us. So for the next 30 years, you had to read between the lines to find us on screen. This provision wasn't lifted until October of 1961, just in time for a slew of gay-themed films without happy endings.
A taut, tense drama of the most untalked-about subject of our time.
First came a British import called Victim.
I want to know the truth. I want to know why he hanged himself.
He was being blackmailed.
That's why he stole?
Yes.
Someone found out he was a homosexual and blackmailed him.
That's it.
He takes two to make a reason for blackmail. Were you the other man? Were you?
A few months later, the children's hour debuted.
You've got to know. I've got to tell you, I can't keep it to myself any longer. I'm guilty. You're guilty of nothing.
And if the message wasn't clear enough, in 1962, Hollywood released the political parable, Advice and Consent.
He said to tell you, before you go on with the Leffingwell matter, you ought to remember what happened in Hawaii. And then he hung up. What happened in Hawaii, Brig?
What was the voice like?
It was Crawley. He made it sound like he knew some kind of nasty secret.
Is that Brig? What's the matter?
He's dead.
Brig?
In his office. Cut his throat.
And there was nothing gay about being gay in 1968's The Detective.
The thought of turning involuntarily into one of them frightened me and made me sick with anger. I went down there. I had heard about the waterfront. People giggle and make jokes about it. I had had only two experiences before, once in college, once in the army. I thought I'd gotten it out of my life, but I hadn't. I looked at them. Was this what I was like? Oh, my God. Twisted faces, outcasts, lives lived in shadows, always prey to a million dangers. People don't realize what we go through. I was raised in a family that would not even admit that there was such a thing as a homosexual in this world. And here I was. And I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't stop.
By the end of the decade, it was so bad that even the characters within the film started to notice the pattern.
Well, I'll tell you something, Hallie. When the time comes, you won't have the guts. It's not always like it happens in plays. Not all faggots bump themselves off at the end of the story.
Luckily, times changed. In 1971, a year after The Boys in the Band, the British import Sunday Bloody Sunday brought the first passionate gay kiss to the screen. And although its significance is often overlooked, the 1972 film Cabaret reassured many a gay boy.
Doesn't my body drive you wild with desire? Well, doesn't it?
It's a very nice book.
Oh, do you really think so, darling? It does have a certain kind of style. I mean, look, it's very flat here. Not much hips. And, here.
It's a little early in the day for this sort of thing, isn't it?
Maybe you just don't sleep with girls. Oh, you don't. Well, listen, we're practically living together. So if you only like boys, I mean, I wouldn't dream of pestering you. Well, do you sleep with girls or don't you?
Sally, you don't ask questions like that.
I do.
We were fun in the 1970s. The Rocky Horror Picture Show debuted in 1975 and The Ritz in 1976.
We're three caballeros, three gay caballeros. They say we are birds of a feather.
You mean to tell me that everybody here is,
We're happy amigos no matter where he goes.
Although it's hard to believe, both Cruising and The Village People's Can't Stop the Music came out only 4 months apart in 1980. That was a mixed message. But the first big gay films to actually put us front and center, to really explore our lives in a positive way, were both released in 1982. Personal Best and Making Love. Finally, there was pride on screen.
Okay. The truth is, I have gotten into a lot of different scenes. I'm a writer. I have to open myself up to new things. Expand my horizons. Bart? Zach.
Why don't you just say it?
I'm gay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyway, there you have it. Beefs, rants, and final thoughts go to a trio of my favorite peeps. Paul Kolikman was the producer of Gods and Monsters and is president of the Here TV cable channel. He thinks queer filmmakers have a lot more to accomplish.
We haven't normalized gayness yet. It needs not to be the center of the movie. It's all about, we're gay. It's a film about being gay and gay people doing gay things. It's like, no. You're a cop, but you happen to be gay, but you're also on the trail of a serial killer. We all have hundreds of gay friends. Most of our friends do real jobs. They do something real. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're accountants. They live in the real world. But we don't get to see people in the real world. We see people in this kind of altered gay universe through most film. I would say idealized, but I'm not quite sure whose ideal it is, but certainly altered state of existence.
Sasha Rice, the director of Mango Kiss, isn't sure Hollywood is to blame for the scarcity of great lesbian films.
The statistics show that gay men have more disposable income than lesbians, and so there's that. And then also, gay men statistically go see movies more than lesbians, so there's that. To really kind of make money at the box office, even if you're just doing home box office, you need a theatrical to kind of make that money. And the gay men go out and they see the movies, and the lesbians, I think, tend to stay home. And shame on you. You got to get out there and support it.
And the final word goes to filmmaker John Waters, who believes that queer film and the gay community are in pretty good shape.
I think times have gotten more censorious, but at the same time, I think we're the freest we've ever been. I mean, whoever would imagine that gay marriage could have been legal anywhere when you went to jail for being gay when I was in high school? Words that Lenny Bruce went to jail about are now routinely on sitcoms. So a lot has happened good. A lot of things have changed. It's the freest it's ever been. All my movies have the same message. Mind your own business. Let other people live. And if you have something that's strange that society doesn't approve of, you can always, once you make friends with that neuroses, exaggerate it, turn it into a style, and win.
This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Don't go away. We'll be right back with Tab Hunter after this quick break.
Dancer Maud Allan coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Born in Toronto in 1873, Maud Allan became famous for her dance performance piece, The Vision of Salome. Debuting in 1906, it earned her the nickname The Salome Dancer. Drawing upon her music studies in Berlin, Allan created a fusion of music and movement, unlike anyone before her. An experienced corset maker, she created costumes that lent originality to her art. Her performances took London by storm in 1908. 10 years later, a British writer published an article outlining that Allan was, above all else, perverted. A trial ensued, the result of wartime hysteria and homophobia. Whatever the reason, Allan's popularity as a dancer soon declined. In the 1920s and 30s, as a consolation, she and her lover Verna Aldrich shared a luxurious villa overlooking Regent's Park. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mike Rutz.
Hi, I'm Jeff Marks, the creator of Avenue Q, the Broadway musical, and you're listening to I Am, Are You?
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, Leo. It's an honor. You're one of, Hollywood's brightest young stars. I have to say I really liked you in that boat movie. I was wondering if maybe you'd like to come back to my place. I think you're kind of pretty. What do you mean you're not interested? You can't say no to me. I'm Jimmy Stewart. I'm a movie star. You don't say no to Jimmy Stewart, you stupid little pretty boy. What Jimmy Stewart wants, Jimmy Stewart gets. Got it?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Chris Ann Eastwood.
Tab Hunter was among the last great studio stars of the 1950s.
He died in 2018. But in 2015, Steve Pride sat with him in his Santa Barbara home to discuss his memoir and a documentary film, both called Tab Hunter Confidential.
When I count three, will all of the ladies in the audience please go,
Are you Tab Hunter?
Yeah.
I think I've died and gone to heaven.
How do you shave, Tab?
With a Gillette Super Speed, of course.
What do you like about Tab Hunter?
Well, it's quite a few things.
Don't you ever think about marrying?
All the time, Ernie. That's what keeps me single.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and I've got a secret.
My name is Tab Hunter.
I've heard of you.
I've been around a long time.
Well, let's start at the beginning because this is a big life.
Oh, my God. 1931 was the beginning. That's a
you
long
were born.
Time
what happened next? No. You had a really rough childhood.
I had a very abusive father. He was very abusive to my mother. And she left, took my brother and myself from New York to San Francisco. So we spent the first few years of our lives up in the Bay Area.
What was she like?
My mother was a really strict, religious German woman. She didn't put up with nonsense. She was a very serious person, and she kept telling us all the time, what you learn, no one can take away from you. And she pushed education, 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 because it's everything. She worked like a dog to keep us going to private schools.
Well, your mom had a saying about being showy.
My mother used to say, nothing for show. So what happened? I wind up in show business. She never liked the Hollywood hoopla. She only did one or two interviews in all the time that I was in the movies. It just wasn't her thing. She wasn't comfortable with people being in the public eye because it was too much adulation. And she said people have got to learn to divorce themselves from themselves.
I was surprised to find you were very shy.
Extremely.
How did you become an actor?
I was at a stable. I had a job out there on the weekends. I was about 14. And Dick Clayton, he was an actor, and he came out to the studio with Anne Blythe and was doing a photographic layout with her. And I used to see him out there all the time writing, and we struck up conversation, and I knew he was an actor, so I kept asking him a lot of questions. And he said, if you're really serious, you should think about doing that. And he was the one who, when I was in New York, underage in the Coast Guard, he got me tickets to see my first Broadway show. He was the one who kept planting the seed all the time. You've got to work. This is not something that you fall into.
I guess your first big break was being signed with Rock Hudson's agent, Henry Wilson.
Dick Clayton introduced me to Henry Wilson, but he told me, he said, beware of Henry, because Henry's reputation is kind of strange, so I just think you should just be aware. And I was. Henry was a fairly good agent, but I left him when Dick Clayton became an agent, because he was part of my family. My mother knew him, my brother knew him, I knew him. I mean, he's a great person. And Henry was so upset by that, Confidential magazine was coming out on a story on Rock Hudson, and he gave them a story on me when I'd been arrested, like when I was 16 or 17 years old, for being at a party that a bunch of guys were at that were dancing together. You know, you might have called it a gay party, but that word wasn't around in those days.
Henry Wilson liked to change his client's name. How did Art Galeen become Tab Hunter?
Well, they said we have to tab you something, so that's how Tab came about. And I showed horses, hunters and jumpers. So they picked Tab Hunter as opposed to Tab Jumper.
So you became Tab Hunter, and then what?
The first big film I had was an independent called Island of Desire with Linda Darnell. I did a test with Linda, and then I went off to Jamaica, and we did it in Jamaica and London, and I was terrible in it. I mean, really, really bad.
But you improved. Just a few years later, you beat out James Dean and Paul Newman for the lead in Battle Cry.
Merv Griffin, Marilyn Erskine and Merv and I were out having dinner one night, and Merv said, I've just read a book called Battle Cry, and I think you'd be perfect for Danny Forrester. You should have your agent check on it. So I immediately bought the book, read it, reminded me of my brother so much that I underlined everything pertaining to the character of Danny, and my agent got me an interview at Warner Brothers. I did a test, did another test, did another test. I did 9 of them. After the 8th one, they went back to New York and tested Jimmy and Paul. And then they came back and said, okay, kid, we'll give you one more chance. And I thought it was terrible, the last Hess, and that's the one that got me the role.
As a gay kid, my favorite Tab Hunter film on the Late Show was Damn Yankees.
That was a fun film to do. I loved it. It was the original Broadway cast. I was the only outsider in it. And Jack Warner bought that as a gift for me, as a makeup gift, because we'd had a big argument. But I was thrilled about that because it was my first musical. And I loved that cast. I mean, how could you not love Gwen Verdon or Bobby Fosse or Gene Stapleton, Ray Walston, my gosh.
Well, if you've got to dance in a film, Bob Fosse is a pretty good guy to start with.
Well, I told Bobby, I said, I've got two left feet. He said, don't worry about it, you'll be fine.
You had trouble with the director, George Abbott.
He didn't want me from the start. He thought Tab Hunter's a little light in his loafers. I thought, oh, really? You know, come on, give me a break. Jack Warner said, I bought it for Tab Hunter, and Tab Hunter's going to do it, period. And you don't say no to Jack Warner.
By then, you were already a really successful recording artist. How'd that come about?
Natalie Wood and I were on promotion in Chicago for a film called The Burning Hills. It was a Louis L'Amour novel that Warner Brothers had put us in. It wasn't very good. The best thing in it was my horse. We were in Chicago, and this DJ, Howard Miller, heard me singing. And he said, did you ever think of recording? And I said, no, gosh. I used to sing in the shower a lot where everybody sounds good, or I sang in church. And he said, would you mind if I talk to Randy Wood about you, go in and see him? I said, sure. So Randy Wood was president of Dot Records. He called me in. He heard me sing. He presented me with a tune called Young Love. I recorded it on a Friday. Monday morning, I was driving down Sunset Boulevard. And when I heard it in the car radio, I almost hit a palm tree. I was so nervous and so excited about it. And it knocked Elvis out of the number one slot, stayed there for about 6.5 weeks. And we used Elvis's backup, the Jordanaires. He wasn't happy about that. But then I've got to tell you what happened after that. We recorded an album at Dot, and then Jack Warner immediately called me into the office and said, wait a minute, what the hell do you think you're doing? I said, well, I was asked if I wanted to record, and he said, we own you for everything. I said, but Mr. Warner, you don't have a recording company. He said, well, we do now, and they started Warner Brothers Records.
You recorded a lot, though.
I did quite a few albums and quite a few singles, yeah.
In the 50s, you were seen as this golden boy, but you were going through so much pain having to hide your sexuality.
I wasn't so much hiding as running away. Whenever something was kind of scary for me, I would run out to the horses. They were my touch of reality in that unrealistic world of Hollywood. I was very, very comfortable shoveling the real stuff.
Is that basically what Hollywood is, shoveling the stuff?
Well, I think you play the game. I mean, that's your job. In those days, when you were under contract to a studio, you played whatever they wanted you to do. If they're building you into the All-American Boy, that's your job. If you don't do the things they ask you to do, either you're on suspension from the studio. Talk to Betty Davis about that. She had 1,000 of them. Either you're under suspension, or they get rid of you and get someone else who will do what they want.
This is Steve Pride, and I'm talking to film legend Tab Hunter. Let's talk about relationships. You dated Tony Perkins.
For about 3 years, yeah. Tony was a very good actor, a very bright young man, had a great sense of humor. It's just very sad the way his life ended.
The pressure in any relationship is intense, but to have one where you have to keep it so secret.
Well, I've always felt that it's nobody's business. I've always felt that way.
But you still had to hide it back in the day.
I never thought about hiding it. I just kept on the go. It's hard to hit a moving object.
Your big comeback, I hate to use that word, but I was doing dinner theater back in the 80s, the same time you were down in St. Petersburg, so it was a comeback. Your big comeback in the 80s was thanks to a queer icon and his film Polyester.
John Waters called me up. He said he'd like to send me a script. So I said, please. And then he said, how would you feel about kissing a 300-pound transvestite? I said, I'm sure I've kissed a hell of a lot worse. And I'd met Divine before, who was absolutely wonderful. And having worked with Divine in Polyester, which was a great experience, it's because of that that we used him in our film Lust in the Dust.
which I love.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because Alan single-handedly raised all the money for that film. It was a script that I wrote. It started out as The Reverend and Rosie, and it was going to be with Cheetah Rivera and myself, but Cheetah was tied up on Broadway doing The Rink with Liza Minnelli. So then I wanted Shirley MacLaine to do it, and couldn't get that done. And then I met Alan, and he said, I think it should be a comedy western, and you should call it Lust in the Dust. And you should use Lainey Kazan and Divine as half-sisters. And I thought, whoa, what a great idea. And he left Fox, and that was our first film together.
Well, tell me about meeting Alan, because that's a love story.
Well, he was at 20th Century Fox. I went in to do an interview with him about having worked at Fox. And I presented my script to him, and he read it and got back to me and said that he thought it was a really good idea. He presented it to Fox, but they passed on it. And then we spoke about that, and he said, I'll leave Fox. I'll find a way of making this happen. He's a very good producer.
When did you know he was the one?
The one. I just never thought of it that way. I just thought, that kid is really sharp. I really like him. He's a decent human being.
You seem to be a very happy person.
You know, I'm a firm believer that somewhere under the pile of crap, there is a pony. Go for it.
Do you think your looks hurt you being taken seriously as an actor?
Probably, but people always put emphasis on the wrong thing. I don't place importance on that. I never have. What you are as a person inside and how you think, those are important things. The rest of it is a bunch of garbage.
You're a really cool guy. I mean, you think of old stars like Norma Desmond and Sunset Boulevard, and here you are with your dogs and your husband and your ranch. And what advice would you give to yourself as a 10-year-old if you could just whisper something in your ear back then?
I was an idiot at 10.
15.
Still an idiot.
You're Catholic, correct?
Oh, yeah.
But you had a bad experience coming clean to a priest in confession at one point.
Well, that was many, many years ago. Recently, we had a screening of our film in Connecticut, and only a few miles from the theater was my good friend Dolores Hart. She was an actress, but now she's a mother superior at the Abbey of Regina Laudis there. So I emailed the mother, Dolores, and I said, I'd love for you to come to our screening. And she came to it. And Rex Reed and I were up on stage doing a little Q&A afterwards. And he introduced Mother Dolores. She stood up and took a bow. And then, like the flying nun, came down the aisle to the footlights, you know, the front of the stage. And I jumped off the stage to stand by her because I really love her and I've known her a long time. Then she looked right out of the audience, and I love what she said. I want to tell you all, there is no hetero, there is no homo, there is only love. And I thought, whoa! She's pretty fantastic.
I know Dolores Hart from King Creole with Elvis and Where the Boys Are. Did you ever do a film with her?
She actually did The Pleasure of His Company on Broadway with Cyril Richard. And when I was signed to do the movie, I was sure that it was going to be Dolores Hart, but they gave it to Debbie Reynolds. Of course, I'd known Debbie forever, you know, because we grew up together.
You were on a lot of studio-arranged dates and things with Debbie Reynolds.
I wouldn't call those studio-arranged dates. The studio wants someone to go to an opening, you go. And why not go with somebody you know really well and enjoy being with rather than some pretty thing that's boring. Debbie's a hell of a lot of fun. Always has been. And ever since she blew the French horn in the band at Burbank High School.
And Natalie Wood?
Nat was like my kid sister. She was much younger than me. And I really think she's just a delightful, charming gal. And of course, I was so thrilled that we were able to get Bob Wagner in our documentary because RJ is, without a doubt, the most level-headed person you'll ever meet. And he never talks about Natalie. And it was wonderful for him talking there about our relationship and all that because the press has been so despicable about Natalie's death. But then the press has a tendency to be like that.
What's the biggest misconception about Tab Hunter or Art Galeen?
I don't know.
Do you care?
No.
This has been a conversation with Tab Hunter and the conclusion of Pride on Screen 2015. Tab's memoir and the documentary about his life are both entitled Tab Hunter Confidential. This is Deep Pride. Thanks for listening.
Young boy.
Well, we still have enough time for a last word.
And tonight, that goes to Armistead Maupin talking about his famous friend, Rock Hudson.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City.
You were a good friend of Rock Hudson.
I would never have defined myself as a good friend of Rock Hudson, but apparently he regarded me as such. I mean, I never felt that I got that close to him, but he didn't have that many people in his life who knew him very well.
And that's a story that parallels a story in Further Tales of the City.
Yeah, we actually filmed a scene that recreates one of the famous beauties parties, that's what he called them. It's where a local optometrist would get the 50 hunkiest guys in town to be waiting for Rock when he got home from the road. And to me, a kid from San Francisco who'd never seen such a thing, it was stunning. It was roughly like seeing a circuit party for the first time, I suppose. But with a movie star at the center of it all. I wrote about that in Further Tales of the City, and it's actually recorded rather lovingly in the miniseries. I think I was able to be in his life because I learned at a fairly early age how to be comfortable around celebrity. It was just really a matter of empathy, really. It seemed to me that what a famous person would want would be to be treated in an unhysterical fashion, to simply link up with another person on a human one-on-one level. I think about that when people approach me and get all weird and googie on me. There's a lonely making process there because you want to link up with other people. No matter who you are, you always want to link with them. And if they're treating you like some creature from outer space, then you want to get away from it as soon as possible. So yeah, I knew him, and I ended up writing about him in Further Tales. I used blanks in the original column and in the book because he was still alive at the time, and I was trying to keep his life private. But I also wanted people to know that this was a real person, and to make the point that there were major movie stars who were leading this weird double life and who basically became anonymous. They became invisible in some strange way because their true selves could never be presented to the world, or at least they felt they could never be presented to the world. When the time came to make the miniseries, we had a choice. I could have called him Rock Hudson, but I was so afraid that people would look at whatever actor played him and say, "That's not Rock Hudson," which would happen to almost anybody who played him because they sort of broke the mold with Rock. So I decided to just basically give him one of those early 1950s made-up movie star names, Cage Tyler.
Who the hell are these people?
I was just asking the same thing.
Well, here's a handy guideline. The blondes are all named Scott. The brunettes are all named Grant. That's all you need to know, trust me.
Cage Tyler, this is Michael Tolliver.
Hello there, Michael Tolliver.
Hi.
Has he given you the house tour yet?
Well, actually, no. Why don't you give it to him?
Would you like that?
Sure.
Sure? Yeah, come on.
Well, that's the end of our show. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, and Rainbow Minute producers, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns.
Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. You can also listen to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Radio Public, Stitcher, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Casts.
We close with a live performance from composer Mark Shaman, captured by Steve Pride on a recorder, which reminds us that no matter how few gay actors or plots we see on the big screen, we'll always have the queen behind the scenes.
Good night and stay well.
Ever since the first time that a caveman uttered ugh, someone whispered from behind him, "Fix the lighting." And while those Romans and those Greeks wrote those plays that last for weeks, well, our ancestors were casting and rewriting. Yes, for centuries we've spread our special feeling. Michelangelo, Da Vinci are just two that come to mind at a sketch pad or atop the Sistine ceiling. Dorothy, look behind the curtain. We are what you're sure to find, 'cause we're the queens behind the scenes, arranging and writing the shows. Even Miss Ross can be at a loss, and so while she sings, look, a fairy scribbling in the wings. Every dame with just one name, when polishing up their routines, well, they all get their flair, not to mention their hair, from the queens behind the scenes. It's a fact that if you act, you'd better be married with kids.
if you play a queen on the big silver screen, then your name they will shout when they're handing all them Oscars out. William Hurt put on a skirt and he won, but who remembers him now? But you remember Tom Hanks, 'cause he knew to give thanks to the queen who showed him how. When you're out on tour, of this I'm sure, you better have plenty of queers. 'Cause a straight man can please, but can he comb and tease? And a butch guy is swell, till you need a gel that's pink pastel. Every dame with just one name, like Liza, Celine, and Miss M. Well, they all get their shows, not to mention their clothes, from the guys who dress like them. Every holiday is just a new way for a sissy to show what we do. Easter bonnets are proof, every wasp knows a poof, and you know that a queen is the one who started Halloween. And so next Christmas Eve, make sure you leave some garland for Santa to play.
Oh, you're marvelous.
'Cause from the way that he dresses and his Peggy Lee tresses, it's a cinch that Santa's gay.
Just go ask Lorna.
And I hear that Rudolph's thing.
He shops at parties.
Where the queen's behind the scene. Thank you, Lawrence.